Well, what we're seeing in the industry from a risk perspective, right, is when you associate risk with failure, okay, as opposed to exploration or innovation, right, you get conservative. And so what we see is a cycle going on in the industry. Civil space reacting to one cycle, commercial space reacting to a completely different cycle. We're not in the same cycle at the same time.
From the Defense and Aerospace Report, this is The Downlink, a podcast about the intersection of space, the space business, and defense. Not just what's over the horizon, but what's happening above it. I'm your host, Laura Winter.
Hello, it's great to have you here. In this week's episode, we're going to pull on a number of threads to peer into the relationship between risk and risk-taking and the perception of failure versus success. How do commercial and government space actors use that relationship to influence, or are they influenced by it in the West and the East? And what a great week to delve into this question, because I spent the past few days at one of the most important conferences on the space calendar. It's called Satellite. It's held annually here in Washington, D.C. It draws space leaders from the commercial and civil sectors from around the globe. This year's conference opened just days after the third test flight of SpaceX's Starship Super Heavy launch system. And if you remember, not everything went smoothly. And that was in front of a global audience. We watched real-time video feeds coming from the Starship and the rocket. There were explosions. It was a test flight, after all, but the world's largest rocket for the first time delivered the Starship spacecraft to orbit. Unfortunately, Starship didn't make it back for a splashdown in the Indian Ocean, but this test flight is being hailed as a success, including by NASA Administrator Bill Nelson. So that got me thinking about just who, or more exactly, which organization was truly leading in space for the new space economy, which is tightly wound up in Space Race 2.0 for the resources of the moon and beyond. Is this celebration of risk-taking and explosions a flipping of the script on what it means to be a space leader commercially? And what about at the geopolitical level? So to get answers, I spoke with a variety of space business leaders at the conference, and then separately with Namrita Goswami, who is an Asia expert. But first, a quick message from our generous sponsors. This podcast is brought to you by TE Connectivity. When the mission is critical, so are the parts. TE Connectivity's components are exactingly engineered, rigorously tested, and certified by major space agencies. Learn more at te.com/space. Now here's our conversation. Hi, Namrita. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Laura.
Now, while I know that you are regular, we get new listeners all the time, so take a moment and briefly introduce yourself.
Sure. So my name is Namrita Goswami, and I teach space policy at the Thunderbird School of Global Management, Arizona State University, and I'm co-author of the book Scramble for the Skies, The Great Power Competition to Control the Resources of Outer Space. Great to be here, Laura.
Hey, and didn't you recently have an article on like America's space programs?
Yes, with the Space Review titled Taking Stock of the United States Space Program.
Perfect, because, you know, that's really going to come into our discussion today. So, you know, I think it's probably best to start off with a basic understanding of what is new space, what is Space Race 2.0, and how these two concepts are interlinked, entwined with each other. Nami, briefly give us the basics.
Sure. So when someone uses a term like new space, what they're referring to are the commercial space companies that we have seen basically change the way space is viewed in the post-Cold War period, which is after 1991. There are commercial space companies that existed before 1991, but they are referred to as old space. And so how they are connected to the new space race is that in the post-Cold War period, the new space race is a lot about getting to space for economic purposes, permanent presence, long-term development. And many of the new space companies across the world are part of that particular process. The old space race, which is Space 1.0, was about the United States and the Soviet Union competing with each other to get somewhere first in space. And if you would remember, private space companies did not play such a big role. So that's the basics for you in terms of new space, Space Race 1.0, and Space Race 2.0.
And who's really involved in Space Race 2.0?
So the countries that are involved in Space Race 2.0 and leading it are China, the United States, India, Russia, which I view as major powers in space. But in this particular race, you also have middle powers like the United Arab Emirates, Japan, Nigeria, the United Kingdom, Saudi Arabia. And besides nations, you also have private space companies that are building the competencies like SpaceX, Blue Origin, Link Space from China, OneSpace, as well as companies from India like Vikram Skyroot Aerospace.
Oh, and SpaceX too, right?
Yes.
Now, the U.S. and China and India too, their space agencies have been pretty wary of risk, right? Launch events always seem to go off pretty seamlessly. And in China, if they don't, we really don't get much news about it. Like the March 13th launch of the Long March 2C rocket. Yes, just this past March 13th, right? It was supposed to deliver into orbit two satellites that were reportedly intended to support lunar navigation. All we really know is that there was an anomaly and that the two satellites did not reach their intended orbits. The Chinese state cable news channel, China Global Television Network, or CGTN, on its website, I found five short paragraphs confirming the incident. There's not much else out there. So what's going on here? And to kick off our discussion, I spoke with a number of folks at the satellite conference to get their take on risk, failure, and iteration, and how that is affecting who we perceive as leading in space and how that defines leadership for new space and the Space Race 2.0. Let's listen first to Frank Baucus. He's 67 and has been in the industry for 42 years. In October, he took the helm of Capella Space as its CEO. Capella Space is an Earth observation company with defense contracts.
Well, what we're seeing in the industry from a risk perspective, right, is when you associate risk with failure, okay, as opposed to exploration or innovation, right, you get conservative. And so what we see is a cycle going on in the industry. Civil space reacting to one cycle, commercial space reacting to a completely different cycle. We're not in the same cycle at the same time. So right now, commercial space is seeing risk as advancement in innovation as opposed to failure. So when we go out like SpaceX and they launch and they go through a mission and you see a great explosion, okay, they actually see that as innovation and the next step. And what can I learn from where I am, not as failure. So they're actually advertising their advancement and their innovation in those missions that other people are looking at. Let's say if you're in civil space and you're in a conservative cycle or a risk averse cycle, they might be looking at that as failure. So the approach is very different. Capella lost a satellite last year in our last launch. And from our standpoint, the satellite was fine, okay, but the launch vehicle failed. That's just part of the industry. You know, it's hard to be in space. It's hard to get to space. You need to recognize that that risk is built into our business models. We plan for it. We expect it. But we also mitigate against it as much as we can. I'm going to show my age a little bit here, okay? Back in the Mercury program with NASA, okay, my age, okay, I was sitting at the kitchen table having breakfast, reading the box of Wheaties. And in the box of Wheaties was Mercury program patches. And I collected them. I still have them at home. And many, several of those missions represented the most challenging of risks, right? Where you had human life was sacrificed for the advancement from a space perspective. That was civil space pushing the edge of the envelope, leaning in on that risk to learn and move as fast as they could into space. With the Challenger incident, the civil community got much more conservative. So they moved into a very conservative, very risk-averse cycle and approach to what they were doing. So absolutely what we're seeing are changes that are going on. And it's just the ability to move forward, take chance, innovate, push humans into space. I mean, we're going to be going to Mars. There's going to be loss of life in the process. It will happen. I'm sure that it will happen. We've seen it with aviation, right? We haven't stopped flying, okay? So there is a certain amount of risk tolerance within aviation and space and innovation and advancement of, you know, the human condition. But we in the space industry need to, in many cases, to advance, embrace that risk and embrace what we're doing. But again, plan for it, be able to mitigate it as much as possible. But it really does define our ability to move forward.
So, Nemi, what's your first takeaway from what Frank said? He gave us the understanding that the loss of the Challenger and Columbia shuttles erased what was once a high risk tolerance that even included accepting the loss of life, like we had during the Apollo program for Space Race 1.0. And that was to get to the moon before the Soviets. But what about China? To my knowledge, it has had, well, one bad accident when 6 people died and 57 were injured during a satellite launch. But that was in the 1990s. And to my knowledge, they haven't lost an astronaut. So why are they so skittish?
Sure, Laura. So to respond to what Frank was saying, I thought the point that he was making that commercial space, especially in Space Race 2.0, are more willing to take risk because of the way they have framed it. So if you remember what he said is that commercial companies like SpaceX perceive risk as leading to progress, leading to innovation, and actually leading to movement towards what they hope to achieve in terms of the technology they are testing. So they don't see any failure as being an obstacle to what they're hoping to achieve. So that's a very important departure. And also more importantly, I think when we think about Space Race 1.0, the reason why there was that kind of risk taking was that, remember, it was in the context of superpower rivalry and competition. So for a nation to get somewhere first, there was this entire strategic framing that was happening as well. After the Columbia and Challenger incidents, what happened was that because there were human lives involved, NASA became very risk averse. And for all good purposes, we hope that such incidents would not repeat with the kind of technologies we are testing, because human life loss in space is very visual and can affect a particular society's assumptions of risk. And so that's something that I thought I should put on the table in responding to what Frank said. Now, to come to your question about China, so as you said, in 1996, there was that incident. What is interesting is that for China, there is this great fear of failures leading to scientists losing their jobs. That's one thing, right? Because after all, unlike the United States, which is a very democratic system, in China, the Communist Party of China has listed space as part of regime legitimacy and national rejuvenation, even more under Xi Jinping. So failures could be seen as a failure, not just for that particular space agency, but also for the Communist Party of China, because they are interlinked. And that's why you can see that China is much more skittish. And to respond again to what you said about the March 14th launch, where the China Aerospace Corporation did not come up with clear indication of what happened there. And so if you remember, they were completely silent. So we're talking about CASE, the China Aerospace Science and Technology Corporation. But what is interesting is that a day or two later, they did come up with an assessment, True News Media, that the two satellites, DROA and DROB, did not make it to orbit, right? And there were issues with their particular satellites. They wanted to do a lunar retrograde insertion, in which they did not succeed. So at least they were willing to come up with that, True News Media. That tells you that there is this understanding in China as well, that there is global interest in what they do, and complete silence might be seen as weakness. So you can see a little shift in a willingness to come up with explanation of a failure. And sometimes, Laura, to explain failure or why a satellite has not made it to orbit takes a little bit of time. So that could also be the reason why they waited.
So now let's play the next interview when I got a take on SpaceX's development approach, which it calls rapid iterative development. I spoke with Matthew Randall. He's 38 and is the managing director for Impulsion Inc. It's the U.S. subsidiary of Impulsion GmbH out of Austria. It produces electric thrusters.
I think it's essential for the progress, not only in the space industry, but progress in general. It's been a paradigm shift for how they've applied this fail-fast iterative approach that you mentioned. And if we compare that with some other large programs, especially compare Starship, let's say, versus SLS, that's incredibly late, incredibly over budget. But you can't argue with the progress that SpaceX has made. And I think if we look around the room at this conference, around the hall, there's a lot of folks looking to replicate that approach.
So here we have a younger guy in a leadership position in a new space company that produces propulsion systems that do not use hydrazine. And just to remind folks in the audience, hydrazine is an extremely toxic and very dangerous and expensive fuel to work with, but it's been the standard on-orbit thruster fuel since the beginning of the space age. So this company, Impulsion, and Matthew, they're fully committed to new space and new fuels and a new approach. That is arguably a whole lot safer and less expensive, but yet he's embracing that high-risk model that the Starship test exemplifies and says others in the industry, at least in the West, are too. But Nami, what about India's space agency, ISRO, and, you know, India's young and boisterous astropreneurs? Both the agency and that nation's space companies are hungry to get in on the game and perhaps even lead in space. But to get that leadership position, embracing risk, celebrating failure as a success would really flip the script there, no?
Yes, it would. And actually, I'm glad you asked me that question on India, because historically, the Indian space program has been led by the Indian Space Research Organization. And they have been very uncomfortable even to talk about delays and failures in their program till 2023. So I would say that in 2023, what happened was that the Indian Space Research Organization learned lessons from their failure when they tried to land in 2019 with the Chandrayaan 2 and fail in the last few seconds. What was so astounding about that was that it was a very public display of failure because they were live streaming. And the Indian Space Research Organization chairperson at that time broke down on national television with Prime Minister Modi having to console him, right? And that became the culture suddenly. So in 2023, when India was landing in August in the southern hemisphere of the moon with the Chandrayaan 3, I saw one of the best live streaming videos explaining every sequence, including with the telemetry, which was very clear. And what was interesting was that the chairperson of ISRO at the time pointed out that ISRO was planned to fail. They were willing to embrace failure. They planned their mission in such a way that if they failed, they were willing to accept that as part of their culture. And so because they planned so much for failure, every single step was actually simulated out towards success, right? And you see that now playing out in the astropreneur, the Indian space startup community, that I think, and this has to do a lot with SpaceX. So what SpaceX has done internationally and globally is to showcase to people around the world that it's okay if your mission is not fully successful. It's okay if your booster blows up. We will try again. It does not stop a mission. It does not mean that this is the end of a particular mission, right? You start again. You work towards scientific progress. And because space is such that you need to actually test your systems, you see this now play out with the Indian reusable launch vehicle test, which just happened yesterday. So yesterday, India tested the Pushpak reusable launch vehicle capability, and they took it up to about 4.5 kilometers altitude with the Indian Air Force Chinook helicopter. And what was interesting was that that was also live streamed, and we saw the reusable launch shuttle, the size of an SUV, land back autonomously taking decisions, right? Now, they could have failed, but they were willing to accept that. So you can see that this culture in Space Race 2.0, where private sector, industry, funding from state coming together in India, is creating at least a move towards accepting risk. We will have to wait and see if this is going to be the culture, but at least there are signs that this is the culture in India coming from what SpaceX did. And I'll end by saying that not just in India, one of the most interesting narratives I saw coming out of, say, Astrobotics and Intuitive Machines is that even if their missions were not completely successful, if you listen to their live telecasts, if you listen to their conversations, they saw that as a move towards further progress and a move towards building the future missions based on what they have learned. Astrobotic actually did a teleconference with all the contributors to the Commercial Lunar Payload Service under NASA and shared their failures with them as to what went wrong. And so there you see a culture in Space Race 2.0 where private sector companies are involved, where they are embracing this risk-taking and the willingness to even share what they learn with others who might be their competitors. And so it's a very interesting world we are living in.
Okay, now, so then let's take a listen to the next clip to understand how deep this embracing of risk actually goes. I sat down with Kayan Space co-founders Samak Hesar and Araz Faizi. Kayan Space provides a suite of spaceflight tools on its Pathfinder platform. Operators use the platform to monitor their satellites, and it provides operators the capability to automatically implement real-time collision avoidance measures to prevent collisions with debris and other satellites. To, in other words, well, reduce risk. Siamak and Araz are both 43 years old and are U.S. citizens who left Iran. We're going to hear from Araz first. Take a listen.
If you're worried about breaking things or losing or not succeeding, we won't try. And breaking down the fear of unscheduled disassembly, right? I think it's allowing people to try new things, try things that haven't been tried before, go distances that they never thought they could. And I actually have two kids, and I use it as an example for my kids and I say, hey, you're too worried to try that because you think you're going to fail. Look at these guys. These are flying a rocket ship that costs millions and millions of dollars. They know that it may not work, but unless they try it, they will realize that it won't work. So I really like that approach because it flows down into the company culture and organization, every person on the team, right? If the leadership is okay with trying things that might break, you will feel more empowered to try things that you've never thought before. Or if you're introduced into an organization where it's very conservative, you will always be worried about voicing your opinion. You'll be worried about being creative, suggesting new ways of doing things, because you may be worried that, okay, what if I break something, right? But there's a limit to that, right? You can't risk human life. Yeah, there's certain things you can't risk. But beyond that, I think just coming from the top of the organization saying, hey guys, we're going to go out and no matter what happens, at the end of the day, it's going to be spectacular, right? It's going to blow up and it's going to be fun. We're going to watch it and we're going to eat popcorn. That flows down into the organization. Everybody brings their most creative self out to build something that has never been built before.
So NASA is a government entity. CASC is a government entity. Those are public funds that are raised through taxes, et cetera, where you've got SpaceX that is a private company and therefore can make decisions unilaterally. I mean, they don't even have shareholders, right? I mean, they've got shareholders, but it's not like publicly traded. Mm-hmm. Is affecting what we now feel is space leadership.
Yeah, I think that that's the whole point, right? The fact that a company, you have a single leader that believes in this, believes in taking risk, And as Ara said, that culture flows down to every single person in the company. And that is, I think, the role of commercial industry to push the envelope, to take us with the ride, along with the ride that, hey, this is how the quote-unquote new space should be. NASA did amazing work during the Apollo program. They opened the space for us for LEO. Now I think NASA's public money should be spent in exploring outer planets, right? Yeah, Mars, Moon, leave the, because these are repeated, already proven track record technologies going to space around Earth. We just need to now find the business cases and go and, do a lot of activities there.
I don't know about you, but what I found so fascinating here is that Araz uses SpaceX's willingness to fail and to fail publicly in real time on a live stream to teach his two kids that taking a risk, despite the possibility of failure, is a pathway to finding solutions to difficult problems. That is actually a pathway to success and, by extension, the road to leadership. I mean, that's pretty visceral, right? Nami, what are your takeaways?
Sure. So when Aras talked about how he expressed the example of SpaceX when they took a risk on millions of dollars rocket, right? And showed that to his kids in terms of how you can actually take risks, that's a very emotive and very relatable experience. What I took away from that conversation was that SpaceX is willing to assume risk, including with some of its systems failing, because they have a particular vision. And we've spoken about this, Laura, before. If you listen to the CEO of SpaceX, Elon Musk, he talks about how this particular capabilities that he's building is not just about the missions that we hear, for example, coming out of NASA or the United States, but also because he personally has a vision, which is building a colony or a city on Mars, right? And he even gave you some timelines in his TED Talk, which included 2075 as a date. So that is a very interesting way to frame a particular technology testing, including Starship, which, if successful, will be a revolutionary rocket with 33 Raptor engines, different stages reusable, and the ability to lift about 150 metric tons to low Earth orbit, right? Now, I'll end by saying that the one way why SpaceX is able to do this is because they have already demonstrated reusable capability successfully. Because you knew that they had failures with the Falcon 1, right, when they first tested. But what happened was that with the Falcon 9 and the Falcon Heavy, here is a company that has already shown the world that they do know how reusable systems work. How do you land boosters? And so even if you scale up the capability of a booster, this company does have the know-how of how to build on that failure and understanding to improve. And so that is the reason why we are also a lot patient, because they've already demonstrated a particular capability. And so the test then would be to see and locate our patience in terms of more companies that come up around the world that are going to do very similar testing and might fail in their first attempt. Right. So how patient will we with them in terms of how long a technology demonstration window will we give them? And so what I think the best example from SpaceX is that while they have succeeded in certain technologies, they are still willing to test themselves to build even more competent, better systems, right? Like the Starship. And they're willing to put it out there openly and to actually include all of us in the testing that they're doing. And that itself creates a framework. We'll have to see how much that will percolate internationally, and also the stature and the competency SpaceX has demonstrated gives them that edge in terms of what they're playing out.
And lastly, we now have a bit of a longer interview with Martin Cullen. And just like what you were saying, tune into what he says about vision. Now, Martin is TE Connectivity's Senior Manager for Business Development and Strategy for the company's aerospace business. I need to point out here, in case the audience didn't pick it up earlier, but TE Connectivity supports this podcast. I wanted to get Martin's take because It's his job to think expansively and position this huge publicly traded company for the future, for the $1 trillion new space economy, and for what's happening now, which is Space Race 2.0 between the United States and China. Now, as the company is publicly traded, you'd be right in thinking that there is a certain amount of risk aversion to protect shareholders and their investment. But nevertheless, Martin is seeing a solid link between risk, public failure, and space leadership. Let's listen.
Okay, a lot of concepts to talk about then, a lot of different aspects to try and bring in together. So SpaceX hasn't just arrived on the scene today. It's taken us through decades worth of journey to get where we are today, when people are excited to see the next big launch. So how have they addressed leadership? How have they addressed risk? Well, risk, if you take it out of the casinos, then the mathematics side, it comes down to people and perception. And everything we do where there's a human person involved, you cannot calculate risk. You have to, it's perception, which comes from our culture, our values, our beliefs. And that comes down to the individual. So how do you embrace that level of risk? Now, risk as a human species, we've been risk adverse for good reasons. It kept us alive. It kept us out of the avoiding the big teeth of bears and tigers and whatever. So risk has been good for us. But now how do we embrace that? It's about culture. It's about leadership and pulling us through the difficult moments and seeing the better vision for where we can go. And particularly in the West, I think that works really well, where we embrace risk because we can see the bigger picture of it. I think what SpaceX have done in particular is it's not really a risk management, it's capturing opportunity. So the flip side of risk is opportunity. And I think the story that SpaceX have given commercial space in general is about making very real the opportunity and what we're all working for. So just like the space race back in the 60s, the opportunity there was doing something before anybody else had done. It was a great moment for humankind. And I think SpaceX is leading commercial space with the same kind of vision of taking that next opportunity for us as a species, as us as a society and civilization. So culturally, I think in the West, that works really well. And I think our friends in Asia have a different perspective on culturally what it is to be a responsible leader out there. And I think within the West, that opportunity capturing is what makes a good leader. In Asia, I think it's a different type of demand from that culture.
Is SpaceX flipping the script on what you need to deliver for space leadership?
Okay, that's a really good question. Are they flipping it? I think they are kind of opening up people's minds. And I think that's, again, what the sign of a good leader is, isn't it? Is bringing everyone together to sell what the vision is, explain what the vision is, why we want to go there. And that's super hard to do when there's so many conflicting interests and people are scared to be first. But if you can make that first step an easy one, you can hold people's hands. And that's exactly what SpaceX have done with the video broadcasting, the engagement of anybody can go see what's happening in Boca Chica. There's live streams, different YouTube channels. You can really see what's happening. And they're not stopping that. So they're using the media around them, the enthusiasts, to kind of help them sell their vision, their leadership. And by the networking effects of social media, that's really helping the population that's really tuned into that kind of social media and digital environment. They can take part in that journey and they have a vested interest. So they want SpaceX to succeed because their individual values, they want to succeed as well as be part of that story. So do you want to have that water cooler discussion in the morning? Did you see that spaceship, that Starship launch, that kind of thing? It brings everyone into that kind of that story.
So what did you think, right? I mean, especially about what he sees as a sign of a good leader and vision. Both SpaceX and China have pretty clear visions on what they're aiming for, but they're far apart on risk-taking. What do you think, Nami?
Sure. Martin's interview was very, very interesting because he talked about so many things I can respond to. One is he talked about opportunity capture, which he kind of pointed out is a Western thing to do. And he also made the argument that Asian cultures might behave very differently in terms of how they conceptualize it, which is leads to your question. And so if you think about the comparison, I think a better comparison would be between Starship, SpaceX, with, say, Land Space or Link Space, right, which are more private enterprises within China, or Galaxy Space. iSpace, as you know, the Chinese version, did do a reusable test, and they were pretty transparent in terms of what they achieved. A 50 meters hop, which is a test of a technology, and then what they were able to do. So in some sense, what you're observing in Asia is also opportunity capture. So while one thing that Martin said, which captured my mind, was the importance of paradigmatic shifts, right, which SpaceX has brought about in terms of risk-taking, opportunity capture, very open live telecast of their events, including all of us in their successes and failures, and telling us about what they're going to do next. And if you listen to the narrative that they put forward, it's a very success-based narrative. But that was also the case with Intuitive Machines and Astrobotic, and I was watching their landings and attempts live as well. What is interesting is that you notice that in Asia, actually, I'll disagree with Martin a little bit here, is that there is also this sudden culture of opportunity taking and capturing that opportunity. You see this with India's space program, the way the Indian narration happened with the 2023 Chandrayaan 3, Prime Minister Modi saying that this is something that we need to be very transparent about and share with the world. India was very open in this live telecast. And then I'll say that they also included concepts like opportunity capture, viewing the moon as an economic asset, talking about how private space is going to lead to that leadership and vision that the state policy-making bodies give you, is a very interesting phenomenon in Asia. If you look at Japan's, for example, the H3 rocket that they finally succeeded in launching, their medium lift rocket, as well as their the JAXA SLIM mission, the smart lander for investigating the moon, I was awake and looking at their live telemetry. And while they couldn't tell us what was really going on with their SLIM lander, because as you remember, it landed on its head and the solar cells didn't work, they were very open about their landing. The engineer was very clear that, look, we cannot explain why the solar cell is not working. And very transparent in terms of involving all of us. They were awake at 3 a.m, giving us a 2-hour telecast as to what was happening. So there you go, opportunity capture, showcasing of technology. And so I think that the East, if I may, Asia is also into this opportunity capture today. I'll finally end by saying that what is very fascinating globally is that because of SpaceX's and Elon Musk's leadership in terms of testing very innovative, novel technologies like reusable rocket, the more important thing is that Starship promises to bring down the cost of launch to about $300 per kg. The success of this particular rocket, globally, people are invested because they see that not just in terms of space risk-taking, but also the fact that the access to space is going to come down so drastically. And that is why people are invested. There is an emotive investment in this particular rocket globally, because it means that people can then aspire to build and send things to space at a very lower cost, right? And then the final thing I'll say is that, and this is what my article in the Space Review talks about, which is that while we have commercial companies like SpaceX building such amazing competencies and technologies, if the state, by which I mean the United States government, which includes NASA and the White House and Congress, does not offer a compelling vision, my concern is that this kind of technological paradigmatic shift that SpaceX is bringing about might not give advantage to the United States because of the lack of that strategic vision. While Musk, as a private citizen, as the CEO of SpaceX, has a vision, but that is not the United States' vision, right? And so my concern is that if there is no fusion between those visions, you might have this amazing technology, but the advantage of it might not lead to US maintaining or being able to form the rules of the road as we go ahead.
So Naomi, I've got just actually one last thing that I need to ask you. And, you know, about the vision and, you know, also public celebration. And that's the fact that in President Joe Biden's State of the Union address, which was earlier this month, you know, he didn't actually mention the fact that just a few days prior, Intuitive Machines had successfully reached the moon, not just slamming into the moon, but they actually had a soft landing. I mean, it did topple over for sure, but I mean, it's in one piece. It's not in pieces, right? And he didn't mention it. And that speech is carried worldwide, live. And it's American technology as well. What's that about? What effect does that have?
So I'm glad you brought up this point, because I've also talked about this, and which is that I was expecting President Biden to talk about space, because one of the interesting attraction of the United States is the fact that it is still the leading power in space, and that nations around the world actually view the U.S. as part of their narrative, their setting of vision and leadership when it comes to space technology, right? And so the fact that President Biden failed to mention the first American commercial lander or company, if I may, Intuitive Machine that landed successfully on the moon, is actually a failure to actually articulate such a vision of global partnership. And the fact that the United States is such an, is actually and continues to be an inspiration to people around the world, right? And so I'll contrast that quickly with President Xi Jinping in his 20th Party Congress speech. He talked about China's lunar successes. He talked about China's lunar Mars mission to the Communist Party National People's Congress, which broadcast as well to the entire world, right? And then the Prime Minister of India, Narendra Modi, when he talked to Parliament, which is very similar to what President Biden did with the State of the Union, he actually recalled and emphasized the fact that India is now a very serious power and a inspiration to the world because of the fact that the Indian Space Research Organization successfully landed on the southern hemisphere of the moon. And you can see that the leaders in Asia are including space and the successes that they have done in space in the major speeches they give to their own people, as well as what is broadcasted around the world, which I think, in my perspective, President Joe Biden should have done with the State of the Union.
Naomi, thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast this week. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura, for having me. It's a pleasure.
That's it for this week. For your daily dose of award-winning defense coverage, listen to the Defense and Aerospace Report with Vago Maradian. And for the maritime domain, listen to Cavis Ships with Chris Cavis and Chris Cervello, and get your air domain news and analysis from the Air Power Podcast with JJ Gertler and Vago Maradian. I'm Laura Winter. Thank you for listening.